Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Kanyat Natsuk, also known as Kana, spends his time spreading Mongolian culture around the world. He does so by creating special masks. The masks are representations of characters that appear in traditional Buddhist dances known as Sam. The Sam tradition dates back to Tibet in the 600s. It did not get to Mongolia until 1811. About 120 years later, the government of the former Soviet Union banned religious activities in Mongolia. Kana says the Soviets destroyed more than 800 temples, including many Buddhist objects. He added that a lot of masks were destroyed during that time. Only about 30 masks survived.
I made the old white man's mask in 1997. Then I decided to build 108-piece masks. It took me 10 years, and I completed in 2007 the all ritual 108 Sam dance masks.
Kana was born in Ulaanbaatar, the capital of Mongolia. He came to the United States in 2002. He has been making Buddhist ritual dance masks for more than 20 years. Each mask represents a different character and the part they play. Kana said, for example, the old white man gives people long life. He is knowledgeable and has wisdom to offer people. When I wear the mask, when I am dancing, I try to tell that story through my movements and dancing. While Kana recreated the mask, his family and friends helped him by making the characters' clothing. He said, my mother was a famous seamstress, and my father was also a very artistic person. I learned a lot from them. I also studied art in school. It takes Kana 1 month to create a mask using clay and a material called paper mache. He said, it takes time. Sitting and making the mask, I think about the character of that mask peacefully inside. Kana also created a music and dance group called Kanbat. The group has performed in more than 50 countries at celebrations, theaters, and museums. Kana has a dream project called the World Peace Pagoda. He hopes to build large peace education centers, one in Mongolia and another near Washington, D.C. He said, if people are enjoyable and peaceful in themselves, outside our world will be peaceful.
Scientists have provided new evidence to help solve one of the world's oldest mysteries. Why does a zebra have stripes? It appears that all those lines cause problems for insects and makes it very hard for them to land on the animal. Researchers recently described experiments showing that horseflies have a difficult time landing on zebras while easily landing on horses of a single color. In one experiment, the researchers put blankets with stripes on horses and saw that fewer flies landed on them. They fly past them or bump into them and bounce off, said Tim Caro of the University of California, Davis. He was the lead writer of a report on the study. The report was published in the journal PLOS ONE. Closely related to horses, the world's three zebra species are known for their black and white striped bodies. There have been four main theories about the reasons zebras developed stripes. The first theory is to avoid attack by meat-eating animals. Another is so that zebras have an easier time recognizing other zebras. A third idea is thermoregulation. That is the ability of a creature to control its body temperature, even when the surrounding temperature is different. The fourth theory is to prevent attacks by biting flies. Only the last stands up, Caro said. Most biologists involved with research on mammal coloration accept that this is the reason that zebras have stripes. African horseflies carry diseases such as trypanosomiasis. The sickness can cause wasting and be deadly. The researchers recorded videos of horseflies as they tried to bite zebras and horses at a farm in North Somerset, England. Stripes did not stop flies from a distance as they circled horses and zebras at similar rates. But the flies were 25% less likely to land on zebras. I'm Susan Shand.
If you read and listen to our Everyday Grammar program each week, you know it has detailed explanations of grammar, sentence structure, and language usage. The show provides a lot of information for English learners. Some of you may worry about how you are going to use it all, but you need not worry too much. Today, I'll give you some reasons why. I will share 9 facts about English that show how strange and wonderful the language can be and may ease some of your doubts. Let me start with this. English is not the official language of the United States. The country, in fact, does not have an official language. While some states have named English, the U.S. central government has made no such declaration. English is, however, the most common language spoken nationwide. Spanish is the second, with more than 40 million speakers. The United States is a nation of immigrants with a large percentage of citizens for whom English is a second language. Here is another fact. Of the 10 most widely spoken languages, English is the only one that does not have a guiding institution to set language standards. That means that while experts like to dictate language rules, they do not have any official or decisive power. So what we know and teach as official is really just what we are taught in school and continue to use in everyday situations. There has been debate for centuries over whether a guiding institution is needed for English. But many argue it is not, and that English should remain a democratic language. The lack of such an organization is likely one reason that nearly 4,000 new words are added each year to the Oxford English Dictionary, or OED. Such fast growth is also largely the result of technology, which has led to several new words and new uses for old ones. Social media, too, is quickly spreading new words through the general public, which then leads to the words appearing in dictionaries.
In addition, many of the words added to the OED in recent years are portmanteaus. A portmanteau is a word made from shortening and combining two other words. A few examples are brunch, which combines the words breakfast and lunch, motel, which combines the words motor and hotel, and carjack, from the words car and hijack. Speaking of dictionaries, the word set has the most definitions of any English word, with well over 400 in the OED. The word run is a close second, with nearly 400 in the same dictionary. But the growth of machines and technology is causing run to grow much faster than set. One can run a computer program, for example. Buses also run on roads, and trains run on railroad tracks. This next one may shock you. The shortest possible grammatically correct complete sentence in the English language is a word made of just two letters. Go. It is a command, which is a sentence that asks or tells people to do something. In a command, the subject, you, is not spoken or written. Instead, it is simply understood. Our next fact is also a fun little way to test your listening skills. Listen to the following sentence and think about what is unusual or special about it.
He believed Caesar could see people seizing the seas.
This sentence has seven words with the vowel sound E. There are seven ways in English to spell the E sound. Yes, seven. You will hear more about the oddities of English spelling in a minute.
But first, I offer you the opposite idea. One spelling that makes many sounds. The letter combination O-U-G-H can be said several ways. Listen to some examples. Uff, as in enough. Ow, as in drought. Oo, as in through. O, as in although and though. Ah, as in bought and thought. Off, as in cough. And up, as in hiccup. The word hiccup is more commonly spelled H-I-C-C-U-P, but both spellings are acceptable. You may be wondering how English spelling got to be so odd. There are many reasons, some of them historical. One involves William Caxton, an English writer and businessman. Caxton brought the printing press to England in 1476 to produce and sell books. The English language was changing quickly during this time, and there was no general agreement on its rules. Caxton tried to establish a standard spelling system, but there were other problems. One mistake he made was to employ workers from what is now Belgium to help with his printing business. The workers' command of English was weak. As more printing houses opened in England, each had its own spelling. During that period, typesetters were also paid by each line, so they often spelled words longer on purpose. As you can imagine, keeping a standard system was impossible. Centuries later, in 1828, an American named Noah Webster published an official dictionary of American English whose spellings we still use today. So now that you've learned some surprising and even funny things about English, you may find the language less frightening. And hopefully, you will keep a sense of humor as you continue to work at it. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On April 9, 1865, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered his army to Union General Ulysses Grant. Within weeks, the Civil War would be over. When people in Washington learned of Lee's surrender, they hurried to the White House. The crowd wanted to hear from President Abraham Lincoln. The speech he gave would be one of his last, as Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe explained in our series.
President Lincoln spoke several days after General Lee's surrender. The people expected a victory speech, but Lincoln gave them something else. Already, he was moving forward from victory to the difficult times ahead. The Southern Rebellion was over. Now, he faced the task of rebuilding the Union. Lincoln did not want to punish the South. He wanted to rejoin the ties that the Civil War had broken. So, when the people of the North expected a speech of victory, he gave them a speech of reconstruction instead. On the night of April 11th, Lincoln appeared before a crowd outside the White House. He held a candle in one hand and his speech in the other.
"Fellow citizens," Lincoln said, "we meet this evening not in sorrow, but in gladness of heart. The surrender of the main army of the Confederacy gives hope of a righteous and speedy peace. The joy cannot be held back. By these recent successes, we have had pressed more closely upon us the question of reconstruction. We all agree," Lincoln continued, "that the so-called seceded states are out of their correct relation with the Union. We also agree that what the government is trying to do is get these states back into their correct relation. I believe it is not only possible, but in fact easier to do this without deciding the legal question of whether these states have ever been out of the Union. Finding themselves safely at home, it would be of no importance whether they had ever been away."
There was cheering and applause when President Lincoln finished, but less than when he began. The speech had been too long and too detailed to please the crowd. Lincoln, however, believed it a success. He hoped he had made the country understand one thing: the great need to forget hatred and bitterness in the difficult time of rebuilding that would follow the war. The president continued to discuss his ideas on Reconstruction over the next few days. On Friday, April 14th, he agreed to put this work aside for a while. In the afternoon, he took his wife, Mary, for a long drive away from the city. In the evening, they would go to the theater.
One of the popular plays of the time, called Our American Cousin, was being performed at Ford's Theater, not far from the White House. The Secretary of War did not want the Lincolns to go alone. He ordered an army officer to go with them. The President and Mrs. Lincoln sat in special seats at Ford's Theater. The presidential box was above and to one side of the stage. A guard always stood outside the door to the box. On this night, however, the guard did not remain. He left the box unprotected.
President Lincoln settled down in his seat to enjoy the play. As he did so, a man came to the door of the box. He carried a gun in one hand and a knife in the other. The man entered the presidential box quietly. He slowly raised the gun. He aimed it at the back of Lincoln's head. He fired. Then the man jumped from the box to the stage, 3 meters below. Many in the theater recognized him. He was an actor, John Wilkes Booth. Booth broke his leg when he hit the stage floor, but he pulled himself up, shouted, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus ever to tyrants, and ran out the door. He got on a horse and was gone.
The attack was so quick that the audience did not know what had happened. Then a woman shouted, "The president has been shot." Lincoln had fallen forward in his seat, unconscious. Someone asked if it was possible to move him to the White House. A young army doctor said no. The president's wound was terrible. He would die long before reaching the White House. So Lincoln was moved to a house across the street from Ford's Theater. A doctor tried to remove the bullet from the president's head. He could not. Nothing could be done except wait. The end was only hours away.
Cabinet members began to arrive, while wild reports spread through the city. The Confederates had declared war again. There was fighting in the streets. An official of the War Department described the situation. The extent of the plot was unknown. From so horrible a beginning, what might come next? How far would the bloody work go? The safety of Washington must be looked after. The people must be told. The assassin and his helpers must be captured.
Early the next morning, April 15th, Abraham Lincoln died. A prayer was said over his body. His eyes were closed. The news went out by telegraph to cities and towns across the country. People read the words but could not believe them. To millions of Americans, Abraham Lincoln's death was a personal loss. They had come to think of him as more than the President of the United States. He was a trusted friend. People hung black cloth on their doors in sorrow. Even the South mourned for Lincoln, its former enemy. Southern General Joe Johnston said, "Mr. Lincoln was the best friend we had. His death is the worst thing that could happen for the South."
Messages of regret came from around the world. British labor groups said they could never forget the things Lincoln had said about working people, things such as, "The strongest tie of human sympathy should be one uniting all working people of all nations and tongues." A group representing hundreds of French students sent this message: "In President Lincoln, we mourn a fellow citizen. There are no longer any countries shut up in narrow frontiers. Our country is everywhere where there are neither masters nor slaves. Wherever people live in liberty or fight for it, we look to the other side of the ocean to learn how a people which has known how to make itself free knows how to preserve its freedom." The assassination of Abraham Lincoln touched the imagination of America's writers. Many tried to put their feelings into words. Walt Whitman wrote several poems of mourning. Here is part of one of them: "O Captain, my Captain."
"Here, Captain, dear father, this arm beneath your head. It is some dream that on the deck you've fallen cold and dead. My captain does not answer. His lips are pale and still. My father does not feel my arm. He has no pulse nor will. The ship is anchored safe and sound, its voyage closed and done. From fearful trip the victor ship comes in with object won. Exult, O shores, and ring, O bells, but I, with mournful tread, walk the deck my captain lies, fallen cold and dead."
Abraham Lincoln was assassinated in the spring. That is the time of year when lilac plants burst into flower throughout much of the United States. One of Walt Whitman's most beautiful poems in honor of Lincoln is called "When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed." Here is part of that poem:
"When lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed, and the great star early drooped in the western sky in the night, I mourned, and yet shall mourn with ever-returning spring. Ever-returning spring, Trinity sure to me you bring, lilac, blooming perennial and drooping star in the west, and thought of him I love. Coffin that passes through lanes and streets, through day and night with the great cloud darkening the land, with the countless torches lit, with the silent sea of faces and the unbared heads, with the tolling, tolling bells' perpetual clang. Here, coffin that slowly passes, I give you my sprig of lilac."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.